Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 146, and we thank you for listening. James, we've got some fun news kicking off this episode, don't we?
Yeah, we sure do. You want to start there?
Yeah. I think we just dive right in because I think it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I agree. As much as I'm sure people want to know about the weather in Toronto and in Minneapolis, it is important that we get to this. This is something that we've been thinking about for a really long time and working on. We wanted a new place for all of the show notes, and we wanted a way for it to be searchable and subscribable and even have comments and the rest of it. So we've moved the entire show notes platform, that's all 146 episodes, to Substack. So if you go to thegreynato.substack.com, or if it's easier, notes.thegreynato.com, they'll take you to the same place. We now have the entirety of the show with notes separated by essentially what would eventually be like a newsletter that you could receive if you subscribe. Or if you just want, you can just go in and peruse. You don't have to. We're not saying you have to subscribe, but if you would like the notes delivered to your inbox the same day that the new show is kind of delivered to your podcast feed, then make a Substack account and subscribe. The other plus that I think is kind of cool is we've had a lot of folks ask over the last 2 years, like, is there a Grey NATO Reddit? Is there a forum? Is there a sub forum of Watch You Seek for the Grey NATO? And we didn't want to set that up. It feels kind of weird to be the first party also trying to make it, you know, it's like writing your own Wikipedia page or whatever. And so we just kind of left it. But thankfully, the entire Substack platform has comments. And we'll leave those on. So if you want to leave a comment about the show or even ask a question or follow up about something we said, or, you know, let me know what I mispronounced or kind of got wrong in the moment, then please, by all means, again, make a Substack account, get in there and comment. Jason and I'll be reading those comments. I'm sure we'll be getting a notification of some sort. I'm still learning a bit of this. But yeah, we're really excited. Notes.thegreynato.com or thegreynato.substack.com, whatever works for you. We're working towards kind of a larger website, a unified space. But for now, this is kind of the spot. You can go to SoundCloud if you don't already have a subscribed. I assume most people prefer to listen to the show just by subscribing via their favorite podcast app. And now if you want the notes, they'll just show up in your inbox every week, because we're now on, this is the start of weekly episodes. So that's kind of a big announcement. It's something Jason and I are super excited about to have done and kind of on the way. You know, down the road, we may turn on the ability to support the show via Substack. We haven't quite decided, you know, what that would look like, but if that's something that you think might be something you're keen on, then maybe let us know in an email or a comment or something like that, and that way we can at least factor in general opinion. Jason, I'm pumped. You've had a really good time with Substack so far for Swimproof, and it's obviously a great subscribed newsletter. And now I think this is a pretty good solution for the show.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect vehicle for delivering notes. I mean, between getting it in your inbox with the notes, as well as the ability to kind of create this community that people have been asking for, and that I think we would love, rather than the slower process of sending and receiving emails from us or doing something on Instagram. I think this is just a win-win for everybody. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, admittedly, I have fallen behind on email. I think I'm looking, well, I don't have to think. I have my page open right now. I have 30 plus emails that we need to get to. So if you're waiting on a reply, my apologies. If it's important or it's time sensitive, please loop back. You won't hurt our feelings or anything. I know that I'm behind on it. It's just been, like I've said before, kind of a busy season for those things. So we'll get back on top of it. But yeah, notes.thegreynato.com. And yeah, I totally forgot. I embed every delivery will have an embedded player for that episode. So like Jason said, if you pop this open in your Gmail or whatever, then you'll have the ability to play it right there if that's preferable.
Yeah. Awesome.
So what else is new?
What else is new? Summer's here. We had a long weekend. We're just coming out of that. Today feels like a Monday, but it's a Tuesday, which is always a bonus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, I have to admit something. Last year, given, you know, being homebound for pretty much the whole year, we really got into gardening. And this year we've really taken it up a notch. I mean, I'm shocked actually that my life has taken a turn in this way, because it feels like one of those kind of sedate things you do as you get older, and maybe that is the case with me, but I don't know. I just love it. You know, we watch shows about gardening, we go to the garden center, we just filled up the back of the Land Rover with just tons of plants and came home and pulled weeds and moved plants around and that sort of thing. And it's there's something, you know, it's very light kind of activity and exercise, but it's, there's something really rewarding about, you know, even if you just have a few minutes after work or over lunch or something to kind of go out and pick a little corner of the yard and putz around. And, I don't know, it's like a whole new world has opened up, and, you know, I'm starting to notice, other people's yards and gardens when I walk by them. And, I don't know, we've got a vegetable patch that we put in this year. I built a very crude, vegetable kind of raised bed box that that we're using for some tomatoes and kale and beans and peas and peppers, and so we'll see. So that's and it was a good weekend for it. We had kind of some cool rainy weather. It wasn't even raining, actually. It threatened to rain all day, but it was quite chilly on Saturday, and I got out and did some putzing on the Land Rover. There was some stuff I wanted to do for quite a while, which was to take out the seats and strip out some of this really wacky carpeting that the previous owners had laid in it and mm-hmm. kind of glued down. So I tore all that out and used this horrible product called Goo Gone, which is, it's a wonderful product, but it's a horrible product, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's, you know, you feel like
you're, I like Goo Gone quite a bit.
Feel like you're shortening your life just by being in its presence. I braved it, and I kind of just doused the whole inside with this stuff and used a paint scraper to kind of get off that gross residue as best I could. And it just felt good. You know, it was just kind of a thorough cleaning. And then I laid down some new rubber matting that I got and used some spray adhesive that the next owner will have to use Goo Gone to get off, and got that all sorted. So that felt good. And,
hey,
you know,
well done.
We're planning a bit of a, I hesitate to even mention this because it might not happen, but we're planning a bit of a Land Rover road trip over to Michigan, do a little bit of camping in, I guess, 2 weeks. And, you know, I think I Fantastic. Mentioned to you that we have a rather sick, very old cat that everything sort of hinges on his future mm-hmm. as to whether or not we make these plans. We might not be going after all. We might try something a little more close to home. But if this trip happens, I think it could be a lot of fun. So I'll leave it there. And you know, if it does happen, it'll be a lot to talk about. But anyway, that's what's new here. I mean, it's kind of the summer kickoff. I mean, I'm looking outside right now and it's blue sky and warm. It's supposed to get hot this week.
Yeah.
I kind of welcome it. It's great. It's good to see.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about the same here, really, in many ways. Like we've got a bunch of tomato plants and pepper plants and some other stuff that we had been growing inside under, I think I spoke about it on a previous one. We have like, it looks like something you'd grow marijuana in.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
probably what
yeah.
it was originally for.
Yeah.
But it's this it's about the size of maybe 30 or 40 gallon aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously it doesn't have glass walls, but just in terms of, you know, it's maybe 2.5 feet or 2 feet wide. It's about 1.5 feet tall. It's about maybe 1.5 feet deep. And I don't remember the brand. I'll put it in the show notes if this matters.
I think you did this as a final note.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Then I'll dig it up out of Bitly and drop it back in. But it's this kind of simple thing for you. It has a watering tray, so you don't have to water each plant individually.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we started the tomatoes and the peppers and a bunch of other stuff, some of which I killed. but now they're outside, they're in pots outside, and we had to bring them back in.
On
Friday, it was like it was pretty close to zero.
Wow.
Like it was definitely under 10 Celsius on Friday. And then there was some snow and some rain, like some sleet sort of slushy snow stuff.
Yeah.
And then they all went right back out and they seemed quite happy. So.
Oh, cool. Jeez.
Yeah, no, it's super fun. And it's always nice to like, you know, have some bruschetta or something a nice caprese salad with some tomatoes that you made yourself.
Oh yeah, totally. Jeez.
Not an effective way, really, from a money standpoint. It's still considerably cheaper for time and effort to just go buy a tomato, but it is kind of nice to do it yourself and see it come together. And I think it's a lovely hobby,
yeah.
Because it is kind of contemplative and patience and the rest of it. So that's awesome. I hope you get a strong yield from all that stuff. I'm really excited for the peppers, the hot peppers.
Yeah,
and stuff, so.
Yeah.
It should be really fun.
The thing is, we went a little crazy and we also migrated some of the stuff out of the veg bed and put it all over the garden. And so I'm like, we have to remember where stuff is. You know, you got like carrots in one corner and fennel somewhere else and peppers in the middle of the mm-hmm. geraniums. And it's like, you know, geez.
Yeah.
So
that's where you got to take a decent size, like pretty light tone rock and then like a a Sharpie.
Yeah, true.
And either draw a carrot or write carrot or whatever.
Yeah.
That's the only way I would remember. Otherwise, you just go, well, that's green thing and that's another green thing.
That's a good idea. Spray paint rocks. That's how they mark the dive sites in Bonaire. I should spray paint a bunch of rocks white and then just write on them. Yeah, I like that idea.
Yeah.
Good.
It would work really well.
There we go. Final notes for today. A can of spray paint, some rocks, garden markers.
Some rocks, for sure.
Yeah. What else?
In other news, I finished Depth Charge. I said I would do it slowly, but I had some time. I took some vacation that just ended today, so I was off from the middle of last week, and I blasted through it in an afternoon, half, and I just loved it.
Oh,
especially the second half.
Oh, that's
it
great.
It was like exciting, and the pace was great. So there wasn't a point where I was just like, well, I'll just stop.
Yeah.
There was no like hard break.
Yeah.
And it's nice. The chapters aren't really big too. So you feel like you have a physical pace of reading.
Right. Right.
Which worked out well, but dude, I loved it. I'm definitely not going to spoil it, but there's a few things that happen in the sort of third act that I thought were like, oh, I would not have considered this. This is super cool. I enjoyed it a lot. So well done on that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's been well received. I've been really pleased with the feedback. And I just got to put out a thanks to everybody that supported me with that effort and has also provided a lot of reviews and great feedback. So it continues to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other one, and I think you got a copy of this too, the other one that I've just started to dig into, and Bill, if you're listening, I apologize for being pretty late to getting to this, is Bill Yao, who is a good buddy, runs Mark II Watches. He started a zine called Guinea Pig, and the first one came out, and I don't think I've come across something quite like this before.
Yeah, yeah, it's a cool project.
It's really experimental,
right.
And it feels really good. I'll drop it in the show notes. I'm not done reading it, so maybe once I get all the way through it, we can, and Jason, if you do the same. Yeah. I'd actually just like to have Bill on. I think I've been saying that for about 2 years. I should just send that email.
Yeah.
But this is a neat thing from someone with a kind of a very, like Mark II has this very defined sort of perspective. And I think this fits in really well. And it just feels really good. And it doesn't feel like I'm reading any other sort of magazine. I'm impressed. It's a nice and cool thing. So Bill, good work on that. And maybe expect an email in the next little while, but thanks very much for sending it.
Yeah, it's a good little publication. And it has a couple of my old chums from old Gear Patrol days. John Gaffney contributed, as well as Chris Wright, who edited Depth Charge. So
there's some good names.
A good link up there. Yeah. Congrats on that, Bill.
Yeah, very cool.
How about these t-shirts we're wearing?
Oh man.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah. How hard can I rave about a t-shirt? It's been a little while since we talked about something like a piece of a clothing that I really loved.
Yeah.
So obviously in the past we've covered and I think I own two of every color at this point, of the Kill Hubris pocket tees, the washed pocket tees.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? That's, and it's a great t-shirt. And then, I have a new kind of great t-shirt that I'm actually pretty excited about. I've worn it a couple times. I'm really impressed by it. It's called the Avant Tee, and it's from Standard H, which is a podcast and a website. And I've been on their podcast. Jason, have you been on with Wesley before?
I have not. No, we're talking about it.
So, chatting about it. Yeah. He's great. A real car guy, Southern California personality. And he's a really nice guy. I'll drop the podcast, obviously, in the show notes. But beyond that, like, even if I didn't like Wesley, which I do, this t-shirt is just killer.
Yeah, and full disclosure, he sent each of us a t-shirt.
I'm
sure with the hopes that we would talk about it on the show, which we are. But I tell you what, he didn't have any expectations or didn't have any strings attached. And I think, you know us well enough that we don't really talk about stuff we don't like. And we're both just smitten with this t-shirt. I think it's fantastic. Yeah. He sent me the gray one. And I also am going to order the other two more colors. I'm going to skip the white, but I'm going to go for the blue and the green one that you've got. But, size wise, you mentioned you're a large. I'm an XL, and it is definitely what you'd call a slim fitting shirt, but it fits really well. I've washed it and dried it, and it didn't shrink at all. So if you're looking for a good pocket tee, like, I don't even want to say it's dressier, because I think you could wear it for, gardening or working on the car if you wanted to. If you didn't want to get a $68 t-shirt all dirty, then skip it. But no, I think it's worth it as far as a good shirt goes. So
yeah, the only kind of similarity I can pull is it wears a little bit like tech or athleisure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's absolute, like, if you want, in my mind, it's at least the quality of like a great Lululemon shirt or something, like where they clearly have kind of gone overboard on the material and the rest, knowing that people are willing to pay a little bit more for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this wears the same way, but I would say it's a little bit less sporty than mm-hmm. something from like a Lululemon and just a little bit more relaxed, like a normal t-shirt, which works for me. Because I wouldn't want something too sporty. Then it feels like I should be working out rather than sitting or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, good stuff there. And yeah, point of clarity, the one that I have and the one that Jason have, we didn't pay for. Wesley was kind enough to send, but I do like it enough to buy more, if that means anything to those of you concerned with such things.
Let's talk about watches.
Yeah, I got some. What have you got?
Well, okay, so I got two things. I'll move into wrist check with something different and the main topic. But I got two watches in over the past 2 weeks that were surprising and just really rewarding for what they are. So I bought the Skirfa MS21, which is Skirfield's. He does a limited edition of his Diver One once a year, and I don't know if every one of them is limited to 100 pieces, but this one definitely is. I got number 15, and it's his blue dial, blue bezel Diver One, but this one's done in titanium. So this is a titanium dive watch with drilled lugs, a Ronda Swiss quartz movement, and comes on one of our friend Terry's UTE watch straps. So it comes with a gray NATO, fittingly, as well as a beautiful rubber strap. I think if you don't know the Skirfa rubber strap that Terry sells, I guess Skirfa sells it through his website as well. It's fantastic rubber. If you want a good rubber strap, that's a great way to go. You know, I had a Skirfa watch many years ago and loved it. I passed it on to a buddy of mine who does some photography for me, but, I was really pleased to get one back in the collection. And this watch is like, it's less than $400, Swiss quartz movement, sapphire crystal, drilled lugs. And to me, you know, titanium, I mean, it's like, and it's really well made. The crown screws down nicely. The bezel action is great. Big bold numerals that, you know, fully hashed bezel. I don't know. I can't say enough good things about it. I mean, for the price, this is easily a competitor to, if not the better of something from, you know, like a Seiko Turtle or something like that. I think it's just fantastic.
I definitely was eyeballing that, knowing there was only 100, and I don't really love trying to do the rush to buy, you know, is it going to work out or not sort of thing. And the other side, and you know, as I've mentioned in previous shows, like I am kind of rotten with dive watches at the moment, personally owned dive watches.
Yeah.
So I probably didn't need another one, but I am really glad that you picked one up, because that means I could probably check one out at some time.
Yeah.
I think it's just a great looking, really straightforward product. And obviously we're huge fans of both Paul and his company here. So that's awesome. Good snag on that.
Yeah. And then the second watch I got was sent to me by a brand out of England called Elliott Brown. And a lot of people might have heard of this brand and maybe didn't know much about it, which was my situation before I got it. But Elliott Brown, you know, for years I was kind of aware of them in my peripheral vision as kind of this maker of quartz and a few automatic I wouldn't even have called them enthusiast watches. They almost felt like, I don't know. I don't even know what to compare them to, but I just didn't really pay much attention to them. But then lately I've been getting a few people that keep writing me and saying, you've got to try the Elliott Brown Holton, which is the watch that they make for the UK Special Forces. They're based in Poole, which is in Dorset, right next door to the SBS, so the Special Boat Service. And the SBS approached them about making a watch to give to their Special Forces operators. And the result was this Holton Professional that they make. It's you know, similar to the Skirfa. It's a quartz dive watch. The one that I got, the one that they sent me, is a new kind of derivation of it called the Holton Nevo. And Nevo stands for Night Invisible Varnish or Fordness, which is a weird kind of green-gray color that was developed between World War I and World War II to paint aircraft so that it would be a little more camouflaged at night. And so the whole watch is this color, and then the dial is this kind of greenish-gray color. It's got the most incredible rubber strap. It's almost like, to me, I put the watch on and I look down at my wrist and it feels and looks like a Zin U1, both the strap and the watch. Cause it's
right.
It's all matte. It's very no nonsense, very smooth, I don't want to say industrial. It's very technical looking. It's very kind of all business. There's very little text on the dial. The bezel is one of the best I've used. They actually designed it so that this knurling, the sort of hobnail knurling that they use for the grip, which is quite narrow, kind of extends up to the very top and kind of overlaps the top of the timing ring so that you can literally like just set your palm on the top of the watch and like pivot your wrist and it'll spin the bezel. And the crown is at 4 o'clock and it's this tiny little screw-in crown with the same knurling. It's not hard to use, but it's like, it's so small. And at first I was like, boy, that's a tiny crown, but you know, it's a quartz watch. I mean, you don't use it. So in that way, it's almost like a watch without a crown because it just sort of disappears when you're wearing it. So I'm pretty pleased with it. It's a great grab and go watch. I mean, I think it's funny, you know, to get both of these watches within 2 weeks of each other. They kind of both fit the same purpose in my life. Is just kind of one of these watches that, you know, it's perfect for this time of year when you're going from the bike to the garden to, you know, wrenching on the car and hiking and that sort of stuff, and don't even have to think about it. And they're just always running because they're quartz, so they're just sitting on the dresser, kind of ready to go.
Yeah, and what are we looking at in terms of price on this?
Good question.
Similar range as the.
It's more expensive than the Skirfa.
Okay. I got it here. It's £450.
Yeah, so it's yeah,
it seems bad at all though. It looks
it's
really
between
good.
$500 and $600. It's I would say it's a lot of thought went into this, and it comes. What I appreciated too, one of the small things was it comes in kind of a well formed cardboard box, and then inside is this like zippered, molded, padded thing, kind of like those Oakley.
Oh yeah, like the vaults.
It's a little bit bigger than that. It's a little bigger than that, but because it has a little slot for another strap and a tool, but the strap is held on with screw bars that have a Torx or star-shaped head, and it's only threaded on the near side. So you pass the screw bar through the top hole, and then there's not a hole drilled through on the other lug, and it just sort of seats in that lug, and then the threads are on the lug that you threaded it through, and it tights down really firmly. A lot of thought went into it.
What's the loom like?
Loom is great, fully loomed bezel, so all the hash marks and all the numerals are loomed. Big sword hands. It's a cool watch. I mean, I think, I have a thing about, I don't know, call it a bias or prejudice or snobbishness from years of being in this crazy business where, you know, these brands kind of wash over you after a while. It's like, Elliot Brown, it's like a slightly anonymous sounding kind of two guys' names, you know, whatever. But, so I didn't pay much attention to them, but I was like, that's a really good watch. It's really a fantastic watch. I think it easily is worth what they're asking. You know, the tie with the SBS obviously has a little bit of cachet to it, whether or not that's important to you or not, but it's definitely proof that somebody is using it a lot harder than I am.
I mean, the other nice thing is I would say kudos to the folks at Elliott Brown for really fighting the normal thing of putting the, you know, SBS logo or some direct reference to military use on the dial.
Yeah.
It looks a little bit like in the same way that you said about the CWC stuff is it has that like modern issued sort of vibe.
Right, right.
Where it's not just I'm sure there's lots of marketing that goes into being part of the watches that the SBS would have, but it's not just on the dial for all of us non-SBS operators to flex in a manner that we really shouldn't be. You know, that was always one of those things that that got at me a little bit about, like, if you bought a really nice basic Luminox,
yeah.
It just had like a normal dial. But if you bought one of their fancier ones, you had to have this really complicated dial with a military crest on it.
Yeah.
And then I felt like, well, what if I was on a plane and the guy next to me actually was in that outfit?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, he wants to fist bump with you, and you're like, "Well, no, I'm a podcaster." You know,
yeah,
I write about watches.
Yeah, goodness sakes. So that always kind of sits with me. But I think it's a good looking watch, and a nice thing, and the price seems really fair for what it is.
Yeah,
that's in there in that like Seiko.
Totally, totally. I'm definitely on a theme these days because it's all about grab and go quartz tough watches. I mean, even when we get into our main topic today, you'll see where I'm headed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what about you? What watches are you keen on these days?
Yeah, I got in a pair of watches, same watch, but different, one with a black dial, one with sort of a white silver dial, and they're the new Serica Diver.
Oh, yeah.
The 5303.
Awesome. Those look amazing.
Man, this watch is really good in person.
Huh. Huh.
Like, I was very impressed with their previous offering.
Yeah.
But this is a whole step up. Easily a whole step up.
Huh.
So the one I have in my hand now, they're $1,200. So that is a big step up in price as well, but not massive.
Yeah.
And they're not punching below their weight, below that price point in any way.
Mm-hmm.
This does not look like other watches,
yeah.
which I think is really special. It has a semi-integrated Milanese mesh bracelet.
Yeah, yeah.
With internal, so that the tail on the bracelet goes under the other side of it.
Oh, okay.
So you end up with this fully smooth profile, almost like you'd see on a 60s dress watch.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's way finer than I was expecting.
Yeah.
The tolerances of the lugs are really nice, and then. If you imagine the lug element, people should, if you're listening, just swing by the show notes or hit serica-watches.com. But the lug element is kind of like a miniature version of that lug element from the Tudor P01.
Oh, sure. Yeah, right, right.
So you have a hard endling and then a pivot and then it mounts in. So there's a link between the endlink and the start of the mesh.
Yeah, yeah.
And it looks kind of chunky and purposeful, but it's also like super comfortable.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, it's only 39 millimeters.
Oh, well, nice. Yeah.
So you can have all this extra bulk from the, and you can still fit a normal strap. It's not like the P01 specifically. You can pop this off and put a normal strap on, but it comes with this steel bracelet, which tapers from 20 to 16 millimeters with integrated end links. It's just not a common thing that you're going to see very often.
Yeah.
And then I can go further. So it uses a Swiss caliber Newton automatic. That's a movement I don't know that much about. Wait for my hands on. I'll dig deeper into it. And then maybe my favorite part is they have an engraved, polished ceramic rotating bezel that's twin scale.
Yeah, that is really nice.
So there's a little tiny, maybe it's a split 70-30 or 60-40 in terms of radius, depth. Mm-hmm. But the inner ring of the bezel is a 12-hour bezel, and then the outer ring is a standard dive timer.
So smart, jeez!
And then the functionality is great. It has a loomed pip. The visibility is awesome. It's a no date, and yeah, it comes in black or white. And the black dial has like white hands, and the white dial has black hands. And it's a solid case back. I would even say there's almost room for an engraving.
Yeah.
Which is nice, and I'm absolutely impressed. For $1,200, they've done a beautiful job with this watch.
And look at those lugs. I mean, from the photos, it's got those sort of twisted lyre shaped lugs, almost Seamaster like. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says on their website that you can choose left or right handed crown position.
Oh, I didn't catch that. Yeah,
which is really unique. That is awesome. Crown at 9 or crown at 3.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be fun? I mean, if you like that, I mean, who's offering that? Nobody offers that unless it's a very specific model, but like to actually offer that as a drop down on the website for, $1,200. I mean, okay. I mean, look at these watches. Now we've got Skirfa, Elliot Brown, and this, all three of them would total $2,000. You know, I mean, these are great. This is a great summer kickoff episode here. We're already starting on.
So 39 millimeters, it's only 12.2 millimeters thick. Which is awesome. The bezel entirely nests the crystal, so they're on an equal plane. So you don't have any of that the kind of faux vintage added thickness from the crystal.
Yeah.
Lug to lug is 46.5, and it's a 20 millimeter lug. Loom so far is pretty impressive. I've been wearing one around for most of today and a couple days previously. These are still in a prototype phase of some sort. So I didn't, take it outside, and this is a small company, and I always try and respect the fact that I don't want to return the watch with any scratches on it, because it probably has to go directly to the next person who's reviewing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I am definitely being careful with them, but I'm just very impressed. It's a unidirectional bezel, plenty of loom, a lot of style. I think this is a really solid follow up from their previous stuff. Same sort of like understanding of what they want to do, but like. If you consider them a micro brand, then I would see this in the same vein as in a Manta kind of range, right? Where let's say you go with a Halios or a Skirfa or a Raven,
mm-hmm.
the difference is they just, it's not that there's a quality in the way that, let's say, the case is made.
Yeah.
Everything just goes up a level of, in complexity.
Sure. Yeah. Like the lugs or the bracelet or
yeah, or the ability to do bezel.
Yeah.
Yeah, the crown on both sides or on right. sort both sides. Either side. You don't need two crowns, I promise. But it's a nice screw down crown. It's also a nice size. You know, they're very clear to say that it's oversized. It doesn't mm-hmm. look it's oversized in the way that like a big crown kind of looks oversized. It's very easy to grip.
Yeah.
Bezel finish is lovely. All of this is really good. I'm impressed by it.
Yeah, that looks amazing.
It's so nice just to try something that's new. Or feels new, right?
Mm, right, I agree.
Doesn't feel like it's chasing either the Seiko world or the Rolex world or the whatever. They've made their own thing like they did with the last one.
Right.
And I think it's just the right size. You know, 39 has largely become like the hot size right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay by me. I think it's really lovely.
Yeah, I'm loving these. All these interesting. I mean, we talked about the Baltic Twin Crown Aquascaf a while back.
I like that watch a lot. It's so pretty.
Yeah, I mean, these small brands have just come up so much. I mean, I know I harp on that a lot on the show, but I'm just so impressed with all of these little brands mm-hmm. that are just giving everyone such choice, and it's just so mm-hmm. encouraging. So, yeah, that's really cool. Anything else catch your eye? I mean, I guess there's the ceramic Black Bay with the Metas movement.
I think we got to chat about that. I'm super impressed by this watch. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it in person, to be clear. I don't know if there's a press unit going around just yet.
Yeah.
I know that some of the blogs in Europe have already seen, have been hands-on with it. So maybe it's just more of a centralized thing. So if you miss this, it's a 41 millimeter Black Bay, no date, with a Metas certified movement. Tudor, this is not only the first watch, but Tudor's the second brand to use Metas after Omega.
Yeah.
So it's a very high level of timekeeping certification. And then it's funny because, you know, people for years have said, like, why can't I get a Black Bay with a ceramic bezel?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now they went the whole step. It's a 41 millimeter fully ceramic case.
Yeah.
And it's this really beautiful brushed gray, dark brushed gray with a matching dial. And it makes the markers in the hands like glow in every picture you see of it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love this. This for me is a lot like the Carbon Doxa. I don't think that they're ever going to move their whole Black Bay lineup to something like ceramic. Why would you?
Yeah.
But it is super fun to see something like this. And you know, it's $5,400. So it's one of the more expensive Black Bays out there. But dang, man, this is cool. I think this is a really good looking thing.
Yeah.
And it'll be really exciting to see if they decide to take the same thing and go down to the 58 sizing. Because I think that would be a really good watch, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It'd be super fun. So I didn't, you know, just because of the timing of our, we no longer have it, but the previous 2 week gap, that's when this kind of came out. So we missed it for the last show only by maybe hours,
right?
We were recording, and killer. So it's still COSC certified as far as the movement, precision to two temperatures, and then now you have a 15,000 Gauss anti-magnetism, still 200 meters water resistance, is 70 hour power reserve, and it's micro blasted. Sorry, I said it was brushed. It's micro blasted, which I guess is probably why it has such a matte finish.
Right.
And then it has these really lovely polished elements, which are common to the Black Bay design.
Yeah.
If for whatever reason you missed this, be sure to swing by their website, or I'll link the coverage that Hodinkee has in the show notes. Definitely some good stuff coming from Tudor. And I like that they're kind of bobbing and weaving. They're coming out with stuff every 2 or 3 months now.
Right.
Which I hope that's something that we just see more of, where it's not all condensed to March, April.
Yeah. I think one of the questions that came up, I think Jack even mentioned it. I think he did the write-up for Hodinkee, was about, you know, why didn't they debut this Metas movement or even the ceramic in the Pelagos, which is kind of their forward thinking modern person's dive watch. But you know, Black Bay is their bread and butter. I mean, that's the popular one, and might as well stay the course, I suppose.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I think not only is the Pelagos a little bit niche compared to the Black Bay, if I'm allowed to editorialize or make up, read between lines that I'm also making up, then my guess is that the cost of replicating the Pelagos with the bracelet in ceramic would have been
true.
Huge. Like ceramic bracelets, that's like the Chanel J12, right? That's like legitimately, that's a different price point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do, I wonder if that was kind of a holdback where that bracelet is so key to the Palagos experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I almost wonder if there's making the bracelet also in ceramic, maybe there's wear and tear. Maybe a ceramic bracelet can't take the kind of knocks that a tough dive watch needs to take.
Right.
Cause you could shatter a link conceivably, you know, we've all seen the kind of scary warning images of the guy that dropped his Dark Side of the Moon. And pop,
oh, yeah.
And just shattered, broke one of the lugs off like a,
yeah.
Like the handle from an old mug, right?
Right.
So my guess is there's some of that there as well.
Yeah.
We don't see ceramic in sport watches a ton, but it is becoming more and more common, largely probably due to the success of things like the Dark Side of the Moon. So,
yeah, true.
I think this is cool. I look forward to eventually seeing it, and I hope that... I hope that it becomes something that's a little bit more common. It's not certainly not their first time going ceramic. I think the Fast Rider had a ceramic case element, but this is this isn't a different line. This is into their main. This is their bread and butter. So I think it's cool. I think it definitely looks good. I like a no date Black Bay. The balance is nice. It's also just two lines on the dial as far as text.
What do you think of the words Black Bay on the dial? Does that bother you?
No, not at all.
No.
But this is like I've said before, where there's definitely elements of watch appreciation that elude my finicky temperament, and like what the words are on the dial matter to me a lot less than how big they are, how many words or letters there are.
It
doesn't bother me at all that it says Black Bay. I mean, I think Seamaster say Seamaster, Submariner says Submariner.
Yeah.
So I think it makes sense. You know, their competition puts the name on the dial. And I think it's definitely a name that they can be super proud of at this point.
Yeah.
I think it might have been a different thing to have put it on the first one.
I always kind of liked the fact that the Black Bay family didn't have the name anywhere. I mean, maybe it had it on the back. I can't remember. But for some reason, it was always like, it's like, this is the Black Bay, but it doesn't say Black Bay on it. It doesn't bother me, but it is a departure.
If you're gonna put the name on a watch, it should be a black one. So this is not as close as they've come. They've definitely made black ones, but I think this suits it okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It definitely wouldn't be any sort of a deal breaker for me.
Right.
There's actually some weird text on the watch I'm going to bring up in my wrist check, which also wasn't a deal breaker for me. Just some weirdness. But yeah, good one on Tudor for that. If you don't know this watch or you didn't see it when it came out, hit the show notes. The rest of that, and we can of course proudly say notes.thegreynado.com.
There we go.
That's where you can find all that. So, but you want to jump into wrist check?
Yeah, let's do that. I mean, mine's quick. I just talked about it. I'm wearing the Skirfa, the MS21, which is just a very satisfying and fun watch. Price aside, it's just a blast to wear. And I think, I think you feel the same about, certain brands, Helios, Bremont, to a certain degree, but, knowing the people behind the brand, or in this case, the person, is just part of the fun. I think,
absolutely.
Having had that great chat with Paul, and having him contribute to his expert eyes on depth charge, just made it all the more rewarding to wear his watch. It's just it's his creation. It's really cool. And the fact that he tests these watches in a saturation chamber in a hyperbaric environment is it's like wearing an SBS issued dive watch, I guess. It's cool.
Yeah, for sure.
How about
very
you?
Very cool. Yeah, mine, to keep the show short and not to go too long, it's that Serica, which we just spoke about. So easy enough there. I think I'd said that there was a weird... When I mentioned the watch that has some weird text on the dial, what I meant is the watch that I'll be talking about in the main topic, which we can get to anytime. Yeah. I'm very impressed by these Sericas, like I said. We stay tuned for a full review. But that's what I've been wearing this morning as I get back into the swing of things after my vacation.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah, for sure. So for this episode, we thought it would be fun, especially now going to weekly episodes and launching the new show notes, to kind of revisit a format we hadn't worked on in a while. And I actually, if you'd asked, I wouldn't have guessed it was this long, but the last time that we did a collection inspection was, we were still in double digits. I think it was like episode 98 was collection inspection 8.
Wow.
So today we're going to do our first collection inspection, since the pandemic, certainly. Because that 98 would have put us just before the isolation tapes and those. So We're going to do collection inspection 9. I'm looking forward. We have two pretty different watches to chat about. So, Jason, how about you go first? I'm gonna pull mine out of my my case here.
Sure. Yeah. I had to dig pretty deep for this one recently. I mean, within the past week, this is a watch that sits well at the bottom of my. I don't even keep it in my watch roll with the stuff I wear more regularly. This one, I kind of have this little wooden. I think it's an old cigar box or something that I keep kind of my watches I don't wear very often in. And I pulled this one out a couple of weeks ago. This is a Seiko. Reference 7002, which was a watch they made just prior to the SKX line debut, which was, I believe, in 96. So this watch kind of bridged the gap between Seiko's Turtle, the original Turtle, the 6309, 6306 mm-hmm. references from the 70s and into the 80s. The 7002 has the same case as the SKX, and you know, to the uninitiated or the less fanatical Seiko person, you know, it just looks like an SKX 007 from a distance. But my own history with this watch is, you know, Gashani and I were driving through a small town in southern Minnesota on our way somewhere, camping or whatever, and we aren't like thrift store, Goodwill, you know, flea market kind of shoppers, but for whatever reason, I don't know if we stopped for lunch or something, there was this thrift store that we decided to kind of walk through and peruse. And, you know, every time I go in these places, I don't like kind of just knickknacks and collecting stuff, but I always go in with this mission of like, do you have any wristwatches? You know, do you have any wristwatches? And nine times out of 10, they don't, or they'll have kind of a bin full of, you know, mm-hmm. really awful
old
stuff.
Caravels and
not yeah, even stuff you know it's the, like really
stuff
bad.
From Eaton's
exactly and, yeah. Mm-hmm. But in this case I found this Seiko and I got very excited given my own history and interest in Seikos, and so you know I said, how much is it? And I think it was $40, and you know it's a shake and bake, you know, it doesn't even hand wind, so they pulled it out of the case and handed it to me, and I gave it a few wobbles with the wrist, and sure enough it started right up, and I was like, done, you know, I'll take it. You know, I didn't really need another Seiko, you know, I probably had a few kicking around at that point and still do. But something about it was just, I just love these watches. And this one in particular is, you know, I'll never know the backstory of this watch unless somebody listening to the show, you know, miraculously used to own this one. But on the back of it, on the one of the lugs is like clearly hand scratched with like a little sharp knife or something, the initials CHH. So, you know, presumably the previous owner wanted to put his initials in this watch. And then it's just beat. I mean, it is just so beat up. The bezel itself, the crystal has some scratches, but not horrible to the point where you can't read the dial. But, you know, the bezel looks like it was just run through a belt sander or something. I mean, it's just completely scratched and nicked up. And you know, the dial has its, the markers have its kind of sickly green kind of fade to them that Seikos get as they get older. But, you know, like I said, I don't wear this watch very much, but I pulled it out because, you know, we're getting into summer. I'm kind of doing more kind of rough stuff with watches that I don't want to have to think about. Mm-hmm. And this watch really fits the bill. I paid next to nothing for it. You know, the cliche of Seikos kind of putting up with anything and being the perfect beater really holds true with this watch. And so, but beyond that, I think that era of Seiko, you know, I've talked and written extensively about my own history with Seiko and how one of my first watches was this mysterious Pepsi bezeled watch that I had back in high school, which was, you know, around the era when this watch was probably on somebody's wrist as well. And mm-hmm. I don't know, I have this like nostalgic warmth whenever I put a Seiko on that just, it makes me just want to, I don't know. I just look at them and they're very eye pleasing. They make me smile. And, you know, I've got an SKX 175 with a Pepsi bezel that I got a few years ago that I wear occasionally. And I've got, you know, the Turtle and the Safarni. And I love those watches. And I kind of have been rotating. I've been on a real Seiko jag lately. But, you know, the last week or the week before, that new, I think it was just last week, that new Seiko Willard SPB watch came out with the nylon strap that Seiko's come out mm-hmm. with, which, you know, I mean, It's a NATO strap, but for some reason, and everybody's been echoing this, it's just a really cool looking kind of braided strap that apparently is made the same way that kimono ties are made as well. And they've got a slightly different dial treatment, and it's just a cool looking watch. And I'm just resisting so hard wanting that watch. I think you and I have talked about it. You know, you've got the SPB 143 and, mm-hmm. and then the SPB 151 and 153 are kind of the Willard modernizations. I can't remember the reference of this, this one that came out last week with the different strap, but like I'm jonesing.
The SPB 239.
The 239. Okay. So I've just been jonesing really hard for a Willard. And I wrote something on Substack about Seiko last week, and like my kind of summer always brings out my Seiko-ness. And so I think I've been cycling through my own Seikos to kind of fill that void or fill that need or kind of sate my appetite for acquiring this modern Willard with this cool strap. And it remains to be seen whether I can fight off that urge further, but I don't know. It's something about this reference 7002 kind of scratches the itch to a certain degree. And I put it on the Matt Supreme from Crown and Buckle, which, you know, from a distance, and if you're squinting, kind of approximates that kind of textured looking nylon strap that Seiko's selling on the new one. And it's a proper summer beater watch, and I just love it. I think if you are not a Seiko fan, you're more of a watch snob, and you look at this, you'd think, for one thing, it's just beat to hell, but it's also, you know, it's not a JDM, it's not a Japan domestic market Seiko. It doesn't, you know, it's, I think the bottom of the dial's like, you know, like it looks like a world timer. It's got like dials made in Malaysia. The movements come from Singapore. The, you know, assembly was done in Japan or whatever it is. And, you know, so for the purists, I think, you know, people always kind of go for the Japan market Seikos, but I don't know, to me, it's like, this is Seiko at its best. This was Seiko when I was discovering Seiko back in the '90s when these watches were, you know, were just bought and used by everybody, including this mysterious CHH. And I got it for $40 and, you know, it sits in my box, 350 days of the year. And then I pull it out for a couple of weeks and strap it on and have a lot of fun with it. And, to me, that's the essence of Seiko. And I like it.
Yeah. I mean that, the picture that you've got of it on your Instagram, it looks like a well-worn pocket knife or something that's still being cared for and enjoyed, but no fuss at all.
Right.
And then there is a little bit of just like, especially if you're used to wearing an SKX or a Turtle or any of those, the square markers.
Yeah.
It's that little bit of flair, right? Like if you know, if you're really deep into a certain car, you can tell one generation from another.
Yeah.
And you can kind of, well, those headlights are that shape because it's a this generation or that. And this is one of those kind of, not forgotten, but obviously 6309, pretty big deal among collectors. And then 007s, SKXs in general, also a pretty big deal among enthusiasts. And you have this sort of middle generation, maybe, you know, maybe this is the 964 of the 911s.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of, it's beautiful and perfect, but was largely, for whatever reason, kind of didn't get the same love as a 993 later on, or say a G-body before it or something like that. Really, really, really cool thing. And it is fun to see at a certain point, like for not a ton of money, you could like lay out all of these and see the evolution.
Yeah.
Which I think is also kind of fun. Like if you're going to collect, I guess if you wanted to collect something, maybe you're actually moving towards being something of a Seiko collector.
I mean, you know, unwittingly, I think you might be right. And you know, I had waxed philosophical and sort of nostalgic about my love of Seikos in this Substack article I wrote. And one thing that has happened or has come out of this is that first Seiko that I bought back in the late 80s was this case shape, I believe. I believe it had the lozenge-shaped markers, which I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure, like the SKX markers, those roundy ones. It had a day date, and it was an automatic. And the day wheel on that one was Arabic text. Which was really weird for me, you know, growing up in suburban Milwaukee and buying this watch. I was like, what is that? I don't even know what that is. So, but I sold it years later and I regret that. I wish I had that watch, but I don't know what it was. And what has come out of this is almost this sort of crowdsourced search. And people have been sending me ideas like maybe it was this, maybe it was that. And there's this weird, I learned about this weird derivation of the 6309. So the 6309 is the famous turtle from, you know, the 70s.
Yeah.
And the watch that they based the SRP on, that really bulbous kind of roundy case. But for a brief period, there was what they called a 6309 slim case, which was a 6309-729A or 7290. And it had the same case shape almost as an SKX, with that little kind of loopy crown guard at 430 or whatever. And you could get it with a Pepsi bezel. It had square markers, I believe.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing.
And a day date. And so people are like, maybe it was this slim case 6309, which would have been fit right at that era when you had it. So that's kind of the leading contender.
Cool.
But I bring it up only because, you know, you mentioned looking at the lineage, and you can see going from,
it's like a transitionary model,
62 Moss to 6105, you know, obviously with a few others thrown in there, Tunas and whatever, up through the 6309. Then you've got this 6309 slim case thing, and then this 7002 that I'm wearing, or that I'm talking about today, and then SKX, and then so on. But Seiko's just a fun world. I mean, you know,
absolutely.
We've talked about Seiko. I think we did a whole brand episode on Seiko, and obviously they've sponsored episodes, et cetera, et cetera. But my love for them is still deep, and it kind of resurfaces every summer. It's not a winter watch for me. I never wear Seikos for some reason. When the weather gets cold. I'm not sure why it is, but I just like a Seiko on my wrist when summer comes, whether it's the Safarni or the Turtle or this one. But
I think the other thing that speaks to where Seiko is today, like how big they are today, is that definitely in the last 5 years, maybe even more than that, but over the last 5 years, the cost of entry to being a watch enthusiast has just skyrocketed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like sure, there's Scirfas and there's Elliot Browns, and there's other stuff that is under $500 or even less than that. But in the wide scheme of things, the core 10 or 20 watches that kind of you immediately get funneled into if you start reading about sports watches,
yeah,
they're 9 out of 10 are 5 to, are, you know, high 4 to 5 figure watches.
Right.
They're Rolexes, they're Seamasters, they're just kind of more expensive stuff. And those watches are all great, but the stakes are high.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And the stakes with a $40 Rolex from a Value Village or whatever, that's not that high. The stakes for a brand new Turtle, not that high.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, this is the case I made when I did my big write up on the SPB 143. Is like, if you've been through the 20 or 30 de facto sub $1,000 Seikos, you might want to start considering these four figure ones, like an SPB 143.
Sure.
But I still think their core is around, say, $500, right? Or say $250 to $500. And that's special because they have no legacy competition at that price point. There's no world in which you see a Rolex for anywhere near that kind of money in the last 25 years, right?
Right.
And same with Omegas, and for good reason, for sure. But as the stakes go up, people will see the value thing kind of changes, right? And I think that Seiko offers so much variety at under a grand that it's just a huge, just a massive presence. And they're still putting out really cool stuff. Like you brought up those two new SPBs, which is the 239, and the 237, both really, really pretty things. And then you have the SBDC 223 something with the white dial and the blue bezel. You know, there's some great stuff there. Thankfully, I'm still very, very happy with my 143. We're only rehashing things that we've covered on previous episodes at this point, but they are just the smiles per miles, the, you know, value for your dollar or whatever you want to call it is just super high. Even when you're buying new, it's obviously considerably higher when you're paying $40 at a Goodwill or whatever, but that's a great story and a handsome watch.
The other thing about Seiko, especially at this level, actually at almost any level, is it's a very classless is maybe the wrong word. Egalitarian, I guess, maybe is a better word. Like it straddles socioeconomic levels, cultures, geography, etc. I always equate, you know, whenever I drive the old Land Rover around, or even actually when I had the old Alfa Romeo, they're very disarming vehicles. You know, people wave and give thumbs up and ask you about them and whatever. Whereas, you know, if you roll up, and no offense to anybody out there that has a nice swanky, you know, Porsche or even a Ferrari or something, but like, there's always this like sidelong glance of like somebody that rolls up to the stoplight in this, you know, rumbling, powerful, very expensive looking sports car. Whereas like something old and a little bit more disarming, people are more, it feels a little more approachable.
Oh, yeah.
I think with a Seiko, especially an old Seiko, you know, one story I have with this particular watch is the guy that used to do my regular, especially when I was heavy into more watch writing and I was getting watches, you know, every other week for reviews, and they would always come via FedEx. And my FedEx delivery guy, the regular guy, Mike, kind of an older guy, used to always do the deliveries, and he always wore an SKX Seiko. And I remember commenting on it, and I think one day I was wearing my Turtle, and he said, oh, you know, I showed it to him, and he said, oh, I think I had one like that. And it turns out he was in the Navy during the Vietnam era.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And I was like, oh, I bet I know which one it was.
Yeah.
And it was, he said, yeah, I think it was. Anyway, so I think his watch broke or something, or he lost it or whatever. And he was asking me if I could order him another one. He was like, you know, internet agnostic. Like he didn't do anything on the web. I couldn't even text him. I couldn't, you know, to get hold of him. It was like, next time I drop something off, we can talk. You know, I'll give you a wad of cash if you'll buy me this a replacement Seiko online or something like that. So to tide him over, I put this 7002 on, like, you know, an old Z22 rubber Seiko strap and gave it to him. And he wore it for like the 3 weeks until the one that I bought for him, which he wanted the smaller one. So I ordered him the SKX 013.
Great watch.
Which is that,
yeah,
what is it, 37 millimeter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he loved it. But he was wearing this one for a while. And, you know, it was like almost Seiko's become not currency, but like, you know, it's just like, here, you know, wear this for a while, beat it up. I don't care, you know, wear it. Like, I don't know. I love that about it. It's, you can go, you know, I remember a dive guide in Sri Lanka, you know, at some beachfront little shack who was taking people out diving. You know, he was wearing an SKX that was all faded out by the sun and whatever. And it's one of those watches you wear anywhere and everybody appreciates and no one thinks twice about. So that's mine this week. You know, at first blush, maybe not something super exciting, but you know, it's everything that I love about Seiko kind of wrapped up in this little $40 thrift store find.
Yeah, for sure. No, I love it. I mean, hey, any Seiko diver is a great watch. So, one with a few battle scars and somebody else's initials on the back. That's also pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. What do you have?
Yeah. So for mine, you know, I spoke about this watch on, I think, one previous episode, but it's my Halios Universa, which is a modern offering from Halios these days. It's, currently available, so you basically get in line. I'm going to get through this part because I know this is where a lot of people will want to understand what's happening, but you can check out Halios's website if it matters. So they're in assembly and testing. They're making essentially 50 to 100 watches at a time, 2 or 3 weeks between each batch of watches.
Yeah.
And so the idea here is that you kind of get in on a batch and then you get your watch, and that way Halios is attempting to avoid the kind of bum rush of their website when they launch a watch. And then it's mostly complaints from people who couldn't get one.
Right.
This way, I think this kind of, assuming you're patient enough, which I feel like I saw this watch maybe 2 years ago before I got one.
Yeah.
The first time in 2019. And the watch itself is a derivation from the normal Halios because it's not a dive watch. Mm-hmm. It's more in the vein of an Explorer or maybe a Black Bay 36. It's a no date three-hander, 100 meters water resistance. This is hand wound. It's 11 millimeters thick, wow. 38 millimeters wide, and 48 millimeters lug to lug. So it's actually a pretty long watch for its width. But I would encourage you to check out some photos. The lugs curve down so nicely that you'd have no idea it was more than 45 millimeters lug to lug. It just absolutely hugs. I have a 7-inch wrist. It hugs my wrist. It comes with a really fantastic kind of flat link bracelet that integrates into the lugs in a manner that is not common to a $700 watch at all.
Yeah.
And then, so of course I got the pastel one. It comes in a couple different colors right now, including I think like maybe a gray dial and like a dark blue. I don't think you can go wrong with any of them. I wanted the pastel because, of course, we had auctioned off my pastel Seaforth. So there's kind of a hole in there.
Yeah.
So yeah, $735, and it uses like a Sellita SW210. It's a hand winding movement, so there's no phantom date position. There's no power reserve or anything. So like with my Auris, I just find that I forget to wind it. certainly not an uncommon thing for someone like me who almost exclusively wears automatic watches. But the loom is absolutely excellent. The dial's gorgeous. Has a nice big crown with a really heavy action to it. It winds nicely. A lot of facets and angles. Has a little bit of like a kind of a Grand Seiko vibe to the lug shape and form.
Yeah, I was going
to
say. Yeah.
And then this bracelet is kind of where I think it's really worth kind of talking about, because they're also producing the Fairwind, which is kind of, in many ways, is kind of their next generation of like the Seaforth.
Sure.
And I think the Fairwind is gorgeous, and I really hemmed and hawed on which I wanted, but because I think I've had at least one of every of the previous Halios dive watches, I thought I'd try this. And I'm super happy with the decision. I think the watch is gorgeous. I love how small it is. Really limited dial text. This is Halios and has their logo. And then it says 10 and then ATA for the atmospheric protection. And then, like I said, with the weird text, so it's square markers, but not for 12, 3, 6, 9. Those are Arabic. And around the 6, on either side of the 6, the word mechanical is kind of broken in half.
Right.
So it's Mecca on one side and Nicole on the other.
Yeah.
And it's really strange. It's a weird, quirky sort of element. It, like I said, I'm generally not that picky, but I know I've sent a couple wrist shots to folks at Hodinkee, and they always go, "What is with Mecca and nickel?" And I was like, "Yeah, well, little bit of fun, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, why not?"
Yeah, right.
It doesn't bother me, but it is definitely a little bit of strangeness to a watch that is otherwise not really strange in any way. And then getting back to the bracelet, like I said, it's a flat link. Single-sided screwed links, which I like a lot for sizing.
Yeah.
But the big value here for, again, a watch that's under $800 US is it has a push-button micro-adjust clasp that you don't even have to take the watch off your wrist to use.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah.
There's a logo in the clasp, and that's actually a button.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yep. And then it has maybe 5 or 6 ratchet points. You can even hear them here. For you ASMR fans.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, and you can kind of, once you get used to it, you can kind of pinch the bracelet and press the button and tighten it right on your wrist. But it's great as that's kind of summer thing that we talk about at least every year, where, your wrist kind of changes due to the water absorption throughout the day and especially when it's hot.
Yeah.
And for that, I mean, I'm not really a bracelet guy, but a flat link is a good step in the right direction. They sit a little bit slimmer. They kind of conform a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And then this, this clasp, I play with it when I'm bored.
Yeah.
And kind of click it in and out. And then if you have that thing where you just want, it feels kind of tight while you're typing, you just tap the button and flex your wrist and it expands all the way open. I like it a lot. I think they've made a really good thing here, and they're still holding at this price point. And I genuinely believe they could be charging more than $735 for a watch like this. I'm I wouldn't say blown away because I'm so used to what you do get from Halios,
yeah.
But I'm absolutely pleased with this watch, and it's getting a lot of wrist time.
Yeah, yeah. I love the look of it. I think those lugs, you mentioned Grand Seiko, and it definitely has that, mm-hmm. I guess it's 44GS or some sort of, it definitely has a very angular look. I think it's funny because it has a very modern sort of architecture to it, but then the crown looks a little more old fashioned, it's a little more,
yeah, it's a bit of an onion style crown.
A little bit more onion style. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the bracelet is very modern looking. I feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen many wrist shots of this watch. I'll look through your Instagram for some wrist shots.
I'm sure I can send you a couple.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Because you look at just a flat photo of the watch and 38 millimeters with those lugs, those long lugs, it kind of belies how I bet it wears, mm-hmm. because it from looking at a photo, it could be a 42 millimeter watch. It could be 36, but
that's,
what's the lug to lug on that?
48.
Okay. So just that sweet spot. Yeah. Oh, that's
amazing. Yeah. And in some ways I thought that it might wear like a Nomos.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Where the lugs just kind of shoot off into negative space above the edges of
your
wrist.
That was my concern. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't at all. And I'll drop a I'll find some way to put up a photo of kind of a side wrist shot profile view.
Yeah.
Because it really does just sit flat and small. And you know, the other thing is I was really quite enamored by the new 36 millimeter OPs in yellow or orange, whatever that color is.
Yeah.
Enough to start considering like, well, if I sold this and this and this, maybe I could make it happen. And this scratches the itch absolutely for under $800.
Yeah.
It's a nice bright color. And you know, if they do a Bahama yellow follow up to the second gen C4th, I might consider also trying to pick up one of those.
Yeah.
Cause like yellow is a watch color that I haven't really had enough time with.
Yeah.
But I'm super happy with it. And the night it also has, I really have returned to a deep appreciation. Maybe I bought a couple vintage watches or a couple watches with kind of like only okay loom. Mm-hmm. It's so nice to have like legit loom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it has a nice little detail on the inside of the marker set. There's like a circular groove cut into the dial.
Yeah.
Which adds just a little bit of fun when certain light hits it. It just kind of adds a little bit of detail to put some depth into the dial. So, you know, I'm on record here. You know, I'm a huge Halios fan, have been for pretty much as long as I've been into watches. Jason's been on the show. I'll put that in the show notes. Huge fan. I think this is a really successful piece. I still haven't seen a production spec Fairwind, so I'd like to check one of those out sometime soon. But if you're in the market for a smaller everyday sports watch that you could absolutely, you know, take in the pool or whatever, I think this should be on your radar.
Yeah. No, this is great. I mean, I think, you know, stark contrast to the watch that I had, and yet kind of occupies that same, I don't know, that same general vibe as you know, I guess it's very TGN. And I think here's another brand that, like Skirfa, I mean, you know, having that knowledge or connection, or, you know, I mean, I've been to dinner with Jason Lim from Halios, and, you know,
yeah,
you can see him coming through in these watches. I think the little quirky stuff, like putting mechanical at the bottom, or how the Halios logo is underneath the name at the top, or the 10 ATA, like, all these little things that you can see coming through with a small brand that is driven by its owner who's designing the watches. It's like you can see that personality. They're free. They feel free to kind of take a few chances and do things a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And I really admire that about a watch like this. So
yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot of the micro brand space has become pretty anonymous.
Yeah,
maybe due to Kickstarter. Maybe this is just me and in some ways you, Jason, like projecting towards people who wouldn't have any direct interface with the people who make their watches, whereas we're kind of used to talking with people who work for the brands or even are the brand in this case.
Yeah.
But there is a nice thing where you can kind of see the personality. And if you've had even a couple Halioses, you can see this evolution of style that went from, you know, making an interesting watch in the very early days based on mostly off the shelf parts.
Yeah,
to slowly becoming more specific and characterful in their execution. And yeah, I think they really hit a stride around, you know, between the Tropic and the C4th, and then now we're seeing the C4th kind of aesthetic splinter off into other things.
Yeah,
and because you had a bezel, not a no bezel, but you had a sterile bezel, a sort of clean bezel C4th, or maybe you still do.
Yeah, my mom wears it.
Yeah, I think that's like a strong precursor to the watch that we're talking about here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I love these kind of bezel-less sports watches because, you know, dive watches are just ubiquitous. I mean, it's kind of the default these days. And to have one without that is just sort of a everything watch, which we've talked about before, just a watch that you just wear to do stuff and you don't have to have a label for it, is actually refreshing. So
yeah, and where the bezel would be, so the main ring directly against the edge of the crystal is actually high polished.
Mm, okay.
So sometimes it looks black, sometimes it's reflective. I think it's a really interesting choice to not just make that, you know, because like on your C4th, it's almost like they pop the bezel off and then put a cap on.
Right, right.
That was kind of like almost like quarter round or whatever, like what you'd edge a piece of cabinetry with, but yeah. With this, it's kind of a two-stage thing where the case, the outside ring is actually the top of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like a mirrored element that kind of frames the dial. And I think it's a really nice touch that probably like isn't expensive or difficult to just take someone who's made enough of these watches to know that it's around as an option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so that'll be in the show notes or HalioSwatches.com. And also, can't really send you to buy a Seiko 7002 to a specific site if you want the modern. Seiko makes a lot of great dive watches. We listed a bunch of them in the past hour. But yeah, that's the main topic, Collection Inspection Volume 9. Obviously, we hope you love it. If you have any questions, feedback, follow-ups, whatever, thegranado@gmail.com. And I'm proud, so I'm going to keep saying it. If you'd like to dig in deeper in the notes, notes.thegranado.com.
Yeah, I can't wait to see if we get some good feedback. I encourage everybody to jump in there and subscribe, obviously, but also to leave comments. I think it'll be really fun to build that community around each episode.
I agree. And also, you know, we still get emails that are largely kind of just comments, like just a nice thing to say or share a quick link or something like that. And we love those emails. That's not to suggest otherwise, but this might be a more natural place where instead of sending it to an inbox that just Jason and I see, it can kind of go to the bigger crew here and we can go from there. And I like teasing things, so we'll keep teasing. We have some stuff planned for probably the other side of the summer that is going to line up with some of this in a fun way. So, you know, stay tuned for that. But hey, what would you say? Some final notes.
Yeah, let's do it. Mine is from, I guess it's a couple of weeks ago. It was a feature piece on the New York Times website. So I'm not sure if it's behind a paywall for everybody or if it's available. I'm not sure. We'll see when we throw the link up. But it was an interactive piece called "Has Anyone Really Summited the World's 14 Highest Mountains?" And I think it was particularly timely, you know, given all the kind of buzz around NIMS's Project Possible a couple of years ago. And, you know, just, I mean, for our audience, you know, we talk about mountaineering quite a bit and some of our heroes and that sort of thing. And so this article takes a very different look because it's kind of disputing the fact that anyone has actually reached the summit of all 14 of the world's 8,000 meter peaks, because there are people that kind of really dig into this stuff. And there are some mountains that there's just that extra little bit on each of them that is either too difficult to get to or not visible when you're at the, I guess, a false summit. And with a bit of a lack of accountability these days, you know, short of, you know, a summit photo or a GPS coordinate or something, it can be difficult to prove that you actually literally stood at the very top. Now, for me personally, you know, when I climbed Mount Rainier, you know, you climb up and you get to the summit crater because it's a volcano. And if the true highest part, you have to go across the crater, and then there's a slight part on the other side that's a little bit higher. Well, when I got to the top, I was just shattered. I was just decided I'm just going to sit here and rest. And a couple other people decided to spend the extra half hour and like hike to the other side and get up to the the absolute, you know, tip top. And I was like, you know, I'm kind of okay here. The view's good. Sun's coming up and I'm tired. So I'm going to hang out here and take that extra 30 minutes break. So I'd be one of these people that did not actually summit, you know, Mount Rainier, technically speaking. And I think this article is very interesting. And it's one of these pieces that, you know, as you scroll, it kind of intermingles text with some audio portions and some really spectacular photos. There's some quotes and interviews with some mountaineers. Ed Viesters is featured prominently in here, and some of these kind of researchers that really have looked into this stuff. And I don't know, the photography, especially if you look at this full, you know, full screen and some of these kind of short, you know, repeating video files with, you know, snow plumes blowing off of Manaslu Slough and, you know, just these 360 degree views of peaks taken with GoPros and that sort of thing. It's a pretty amazing article if you're into this stuff. So definitely check it out. We'll put a link in the show notes, and hopefully it's not living behind a paywall for those of you that aren't subscribers to the New York Times.
Yeah, I just clicked into it. I don't have a subscription and I didn't hit a paywall. I'm scrolling through this and just kind of getting lost in it. So I'm pretty excited to actually go back and read this. I remember you mentioning it in our Slack.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, hey, anything with Mr. Viesters, I'm a big fan. He's featured prominently in the piece I just wrote for Hodinkee's new magazine.
Oh, nice.
About the Explorer 2. This is incredible, and it is an interesting topic. You know, we've heard sometimes this comes up where geological happenings change the summit, and then people start to have those arguments. And I think that's like a That's dumb. Like, if you got to the top of the mountain in 1953 and it's the top was, you know, 10 feet lower due to an avalanche or something 2 years later, it's still the top, right?
Yeah.
Like the top, I think, and it largely, I guess the point I'm making is the point this article makes, like there is a top and that's the summit. And to go to the area next to the top isn't quite summiting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, really, really, really impressive piece. And not that you'd expect anything less. It's the New York Times, but yeah.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure. Good pick. Mine is a movie that I've been reading that people aren't crazy about. And I guess I just wanted to provide a slightly different perspective on it. It's a new one, which you can rent because, of course, you can't really go to movie theaters all that reliably now. So you can rent it. And I did so. I did so for one specific reason. The screenwriter for this movie is probably my favorite writer out there right now, Taylor Sheridan. I've talked about Mr. Sheridan many times on the podcast in the past because I pretty much put one of his movies into every film club so far. This is the gentleman that did Sicario and Wind River and the bank robbery one with Chris Pine and Ben Foster.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So good. Whatever that's called. I gave you enough to find it on IMDb. But and anyways, this new one is called Those Who Wish Me Dead. And it's I think that people expected something more like a Sicario or even more like a Wind River.
Yeah.
And I don't know, and this is directed and written by, the screenplay was written by Sheridan. So it's a Taylor Sheridan film, much like those other ones. But in my way, I watched it and the lead in the film is Angelina Jolie. She's one of probably my least favorite actresses.
Huh.
I've never really understood the cult that follows her. She's done some okay movies and I thought the movie that she directed was really quite lovely, but it has a lot of other people that I'm really big fans of. Nicholas Holt is in this and Jake Weber and John Barenthal, Tyler Perry. And it's about I'll make it easy. I'll read the IMDb description. A teenage murder witness finds himself pursued by twin assassins in the Montana wilderness with a survival expert tasked with protecting him as a forest fire threatens to consume all of them. So it is this kind of, I would call it more of like a set piece drama, a little bit of an action drama. There's some guns and some punching and some fighting and all that kind of stuff. But it all wraps around Jolie plays a sort of like one of those people that hangs out in a watchtower.
Yeah.
Probably, I guess that's for the fire, the Forest Service. I'm not really sure of the derivation there, but, and that's her job. And then she gets tangled up in this kind of, bumbled assassination, that was, you know, that left, a young boy still alive and lost in the woods. And I think I think it's currently holding a 6 out of 10 on IMDb, which doesn't seem fair. I don't like this movie as much as say Sicario or Wind River. But I do think that it's a really good, like, B+, A-, sort of action thriller. And I think the important thing is, for those of you who are not on the older side of our audience, but in my age or older, you'll remember a movie called Cliffhanger.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember Cliffhanger?
Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So Cliffhanger was about a mountaineer and guide played by Sylvester Stallone, who comes across a downed plane with something in the plane that bad guys want.
Yeah.
And the bad guys played by John Lithgow. And I remember really fondly watching Cliffhanger a lot growing up. You know, my parents had taped a copy from cable that, you know, had the swears and whatever else pulled out of it. So it was just a lot of shooting and punching and running around in the woods.
Yeah.
But it also had some fun climbing and beautiful scenery. And I think that's what you get in Those Who Wish Me Dead, is a sort of modern interpretation of that formula. And I think within that guise, the movie's very successful. It's super watchable. It's definitely the kind of thing where, like, if cable was still a thing in 5 or 10 years, this would be on every now and then, because it is kind of a step in, step out, not unlike like Cliffhanger is really what kept kind of coming to my mind with it. So yeah, I'll obviously throw it in the show notes. Check out a trailer right now. I think it'll cost you $20 to rent it. So if you're looking for something to watch on a Friday night, I really think that if you don't, I guess it didn't necessarily have the, like, emotional gravitas that Wind River had, but also in some ways that makes it, like, easier to watch and just appreciate for being a bit of a romp.
It sounds like a proper summer movie. I mean, summer, you know, it's like you throw your Seiko on and watch this movie, you know?
Yeah, it definitely has like a beat up 7002 vibe for sure.
Yeah.
I was happy with it. I like an assassin's chasing people in the woods movie. I know that's not necessarily a genre, but I'm sure I could find another 10 if you gave me time.
Yeah.
And just a huge Sheridan fan. So yeah, this is one that I watched recently and enjoyed, and then went and read some kind of critical thoughts about it. Not critical negative, just critical, like from movie critics. It's a bit of a pivot, but not in a way that I think is super hard to understand. So I enjoyed it. Jolie's good in it, and a fun one, and I think definitely worth the $20, especially if you've exhausted your Netflix watch list at this point, which I think many of us have.
Cool. Yeah. Good summer kickoff film, and reminds me we probably are due for a film club at one of these weeks.
Yeah, you gotta find it. It gets harder and harder to find 10,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We might have to drop the film club down to two movies an episode or something like that.
Yeah, might as well, sure. Yeah, let's do it.
I also have been watching almost anything that's kind of set outside. I think my brain really wants outside time. I just finished another Taylor Sheridan show called Yellowstone, which is all set in Montana, and like a lot of it is just Kevin Costner standing in a field looking at mountains, and that's in my zone. I like it. And the movie that I forgot the name of is Hell or High Water. An absolute watch.
Oh yeah,
really good. But we've gone plenty long here, so let's end the show. What do you think?
Yeah, let's bring it home. As always, thanks so much for listening. Hit the show notes via notes.thegreynado.com. Proudly, we say. Or the feed for more details. You can follow us on Instagram at Jason Heaton, at J.E. Stacey, and follow the show, as always, at The Grey Nado. If you have any questions for us, please write thegreynado@gmail.com, and please keep sending in those voice memos. We'll get around to another Q&A here one of these coming weeks. Please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "Good luck is another name for tenacity of purpose."